I'm just waiting to see on LinkedIn Live that we are live. It's loading. Let's see. I see we are loading. Okay, we are live now. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to another session. I need to mute this. Good. Let me start again. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's session of our Ask Me Anything series around investment and funding, particularly tailored for early stage biotech startups. I am Dr. Adrienne Lusa, and I'm your moderator for today's session, and I'm thrilled that you're all able to join us, whether you're joining us on this LinkedIn Live session or you are watching the recording later on. Today, we are joined by an esteemed panel of speakers that bring a wealth of knowledge and expertise in both the biotech industry as well as the legal and IP commercialization aspects that relates to the biotech. So today I'm really thrilled to be joined by two ladies, Shereen Trulock, who is a partner with Spoor and Fisher, a legal firm out here in South Africa, as well as Lucy Ant, who's joining us all the way from Berlin in Germany, and she is affiliated with Hagen & Lovells, another law firm, and Dr. Weasley Fehane, who has been with us on previous sessions, and he will be telling us about his new he's joining us here under a new capacity, but again, still going to support us with his insights on IP commercialization. Well, welcome to everyone, and I'll just give everyone a minute to give their welcoming remarks. Dr. Weasley, do you want to go first? Yeah.
Absolutely. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen and colleagues, listeners from all over the world. I'm happy to be part of this another series of Ask Me Anything. Typically, you know, we talk about biotech-related opportunities. And so, you know, as a former scientist, this is something I'm very passionate about, having worked in laboratories, but also having funded and now looking at the commercialization of, in essence, technologies coming from universities. I used to work for the Technology Innovation Agency, but now I've joined the University of Johannesburg as the executive manager of UJ Invent, a private company which is wholly owned by the university, set up to commercialize intellectual property coming from the university. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weasley. Can I ask maybe Shereen to join us also on introductory remarks? Sure.
Thank you very much, Adrienne. Yes, so I'm Shereen Trulock. I am a patent attorney, so I'm primarily involved in helping people protect inventions in the biotech space. My background is also biotechnology, having spent about 15 years now in the field of intellectual property assessment, management, and now protection. So hopefully can give a quite rounded view of why intellectual property is important for biotech startups and why it's important to start thinking about it early on.
Thank you so much, Shereen. And over to Lucy, who's joining us all the way from Berlin.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. Thanks for joining in. I'm Lucy. I'm a senior associate at Hagen & Lovells and specialize in venture capital transactions and M&A deals. And I'm happy to share the perspective of, let's say, a continental European or international investor in the venture capital space today, especially on all things due diligence and data rooms, and particularly focusing on IP aspects, which I regularly do in my daily job. Thanks.
Thanks so much. So after that round of introduction of our speakers or our guests this morning, I just want to reiterate our goal for this session, just to keep us in scope. So today we are going to be talking about the essentials of legal and funding strategies for biotech startups, which is a critical foundation when navigating the growth of your biotech company, as well as securing a future that is competitive in the industry. So we'll explore everything from IP management to how, you know, attracting, how the legal foundations that you set can also help in attracting the right investors, and how to navigate early legal hurdles. So we will be not only taking getting insights from our guests through questions that we've already prepared and some discussion points that we've prepared for you, but we are happy, because we are on a live streaming platform, we'll be happy to take your questions as well. So at this point, maybe if you're joining us live, if you can kindly put in the chat who you are, where you're joining us from, and maybe one or two things that you seek to get out of this session, that will also be very helpful. And as we do carry on the conversation, if you do have any questions that prompt or come to mind, please put them in the chat, and I will be relaying that to our guests before the end of the session, or offline, and then sending through feedback to you. And also, this is because we are live and because we are on a networking platform, please take the opportunity to notice who else is on the call and reach out and network for other opportunities and insights that can come from peers that are on the same journey, or our experts that are on the call right now. So on that note, I'm going to kickstart the conversation by turning to Dr. Vuyisile. And Dr. Vuyisile, I would like to ask you to maybe give us a brief rundown of what are some of the essential legal structures that needs to be available when one is building a biotech startup. What are some of the legal considerations to upfront start considering?
Yeah, so I think it will depend really on, I suppose, the origins and how this particular startup has started. We typically try and keep the costs of staff down. So it's not necessary, for argument's sake, to have a legal person within the company, because at that time as a startup, you don't have enough funding to be able to support a large staff complement. So ideally, you'd want to outsource these services, particularly which relates to contracts. And so, you know, we try to get startups to embrace the idea that there are various law firms that they should access. Some of our colleagues are here today. They should have these, let's call them contracts with these law firms, to assist them with matters of contracting, but also with matters of protecting their intellectual property. We often say that, you know, do not, although it's possible, do not go away and try and register your own intellectual property with our CIPC without the support of law firms, IP law firms. And so that's critical, to have to know what you know and know what you don't know, but also be able to source in the skills that one requires. And I say this because, you know, the biotech space, as you know, colleagues, is an expensive space. We spend a lot of money to develop our technologies. The return on investment is often delayed. I mean, when we look at some of the biodrugs development, anywhere from around 100 million to 300 million US dollars it takes to bring a product onto the market. And these are some of the McKinsey numbers. And so having made these kinds of investments, if you're able to, it's very important, you know, that the patents are well protected in those territories where there's an opportunity to commercialize one's IP. And so we encourage, startups to have the support of law firms to help them with their legal aspects, including IP aspects as well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pehane, for that brief overview of some of the legal essentials that biotech startups should be considering right off, starting a venture or a biotech company. And thank you for highlighting that, you know, trying to keep costs low also means that you need to be strategic about how you get legal support by outsourcing to some of the specialized firms, and also where it makes sense to do so. And I was wondering what is the importance really of choosing the right legal structure for biotech startups? You've mentioned the cost element. Is there anything that speaks to maybe the specific sector of a biotech company?
Absolutely. So, as you know, we have industrial biotech, medical biotech, and various other, sectors and disciplines of biotech. And ultimately, what you want to do as a startup is to study these IP law firms very well and to understand what expertise exists within the IP law firms. And so you'll find this expertise, but it's really up to the entrepreneur to go out there and engage with the law firms, because it's only through engagement that you understand who is sitting in these law firms and do they really have the expertise that you require. A lot of it also has to do with the ability to be able to defend that which you are putting up. So in essence, you should be understanding that there is a very strong litigation department, and particularly litigation in the biotech space. That's very, very important because, you know, as one goes out, goes around the world, protects IP, there will be challenges, or there may be challenges to your IP. And what you want is to be able to select that law firm that has both expertise around, you know, the specific biotech space, but also the ability to litigate. The law firms will tell you themselves that they're very good, just in essence, in terms of IP prosecution, be able to tell you about the dates when certain renewals are required and so forth. And that, of course, we cannot take away from the law firms. They do this very well. But it's also important as yourself, as a startup, to be able to attend to what they call the office actions. Because without attending to these things, you can wake up and find that, you know, your patents have simply expired. Or you might find that you've missed your particular deadlines. And so these patents are no longer valid. Very, very important that you're able to stay close to these IP law firms because they know what's happening out there. In my experience, with getting into international territories, very, very important as well that the law firm has the ability to protect your IP, defend your IP, to go into court, even in foreign territories. And so one is looking for IP law firms that either have an office in various jurisdictions around the world, or that will be able to partner up, have partners in these foreign jurisdictions that can assist you with the protection of your IP. Very, very important, you know, to do your homework. If law firms don't have that, do not, I say with the greatest respect, engage with them because you will come short as far as your innovation is concerned.
Mm. Thank you so much for that very insightful contribution. I think you've raised some really critical points, which is really, really specific to intellectual property. And that brings me to my next question to Shireen, who is affiliated with one of the law firms that have a reputation for working really closely in this industry. So Shireen, from what Dr. Pehane has shared, do you have any additional thoughts? And can you maybe also tell us a little bit more about what it means to protect intellectual property in the context of a new biotech startup?
Absolutely. So I think very importantly, the first and foremost thing is that nobody ever needed intellectual property to start a business and have a business going. I can go and sell chips on the corner, without any intellectual property. So you don't need intellectual property for a business. Mm. However, in the biotech space, which we know is a fast-moving space, it is a tool, simply a tool for protecting your competitive advantage, for saying, I got here first, and I am ring-fencing what I have come up with, creations of my own intellect and thought, and I'm going to ring-fence them to be the only one that is allowed to do this for a certain period of time, okay, to be able to practice my invention. So it's very important that it is simply a commercial tool, and as such, it needs to speak to the business strategy. What is it that the business aims to achieve? If the business aims to achieve selling a product that is very applicable to maybe a low resource area, and you know they're looking, they don't have a big footprint, they're not looking to expand, they're looking to service a market in South Africa, for example, then it's not necessary to have a whole bunch of international patents, right? So it's very important that, you know, we was talking about looking at various jurisdictions and being able to enforce your IP in those jurisdictions. But all of that speaks to what the business is intending to do and what its commercial strategy is. So this is kind of the first and foremost. I have a lot of people come in and say, you know, I want a patent for what I'm doing because I don't want anyone to steal it. And then you sort of start to unravel, well, what does that actually mean? And, you know, they have no plans to actually exercise the patent. Then you have a very expensive piece of paper. So I think that's the first and foremost. So identifying what your key intellectual property is for your business to be able to attract funding, to be able to grow, to be able to, you know, set out proof of concept of what it is aiming to achieve. Those are very important things, and they need to be looked at the context of the business as a whole. Also, quite importantly, so aside from protecting your own IP, you need to be able to make sure that you respect the rights of others. So make sure that you understand what rights other people have in the space. And that can get really quite tricky. And it's generally only done when the business starts to find some legs. But it's on that side of things, you're mitigating a risk of someone coming after you and saying, you know, you are treading on my territory, my toes. So it's, you know, protecting your own IP, respecting other people's intellectual property. And then, as I said, your protection of your own IP needs to speak to what your business goals are. So how you exploit your IP. Are you intending to license it to other people? Are you intending to license it exclusively to one party? So it depends. What kind of arrangements are you looking at? Are you intending to exercise your rights in some jurisdictions and allow other people to exercise rights in other jurisdictions? And all of these things together form what we call an IP management strategy. So how are you managing your IP? How are you managing what your business does in relation to other people's IP? And then how are you going to take your IP to market? So I think those are really the key things as a startup venture people need to be looking at. And you know, spending time understanding, because these are quite complex things, but to spend the time understanding, how is this important to my business? How do I intend to follow through with this? And then is it even worthwhile to do it, given all of that?
I really like the point you make about the fact that you do not necessarily need IP, you know, your own IP to start a business. And in that regard, that also opens room for how do you then create competitive advantage if you are not generating IP. I think that's something I would love to know. But how then do you go about protecting your IP and making sure that if you are putting in, you know, the investment to protect your IP and file patents, that you actually utilize that and not just spend that money without it being part of your strategy, and just what that strategy is as well, to be very clear about that. I know when we spoke offline, you mentioned something about the three pillars of IP management. You care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, those three pillars of IP management are: first pillar, protecting. So that involves figuring out what it is you have, what it is that is even protectable, and then whether it's worthwhile doing that and where. So first pillar, protect. The second pillar, respect. Respect the IP of others. And that can even be a resource. You know, you say, how do you protect competitive advantage? Competitive advantage can be protected via, you know, distribution agreements, via all sorts of other mechanisms. You know, you can have a license to someone's IP yourself, and if it's exclusive, then you don't need to go out and get patents on your own. Mm-hmm. So there are many ways that IP can support a business without you actually having to expend the money. Obviously, where you're looking for big investment, you need to be showing two things: that you are protecting and that you are respecting. And then the third pillar is exploiting. So how are you actually going to do that? What are the mechanisms? You know, are you just going to use it as a fence to keep other people out? Or are you going to use it much more strategically? I have a patent for one aspect of an invention, and I'd maybe like to have a license to a different aspect. And how can I work with another party to maybe cross license? So I get access to their invention and they get access to my invention. So our three pillars are protect, respect, and exploit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for putting that so succinctly and very, very clearly, I think. And I'd like to find out from Lucy, given the context that we and Shireen have laid, coming from someone who has expertise or experience in doing due diligence for, say, investors who are looking for investment opportunities, what should a biotech startup be thinking about on this basis, whether it's IP they have or it's IP they respectfully exploiting? What are some of the critical elements that they should be looking to really make sure they are on point on, so that it favors them when you do due diligence on behalf of investors?
Sure. So maybe let's quickly, I'll give a quick overview over the IP assets that a IP due diligence would usually entail if you're mm-hmm. looking for us. So the perspective I'm having now is like an investor looking into a company, looking into all the documentation of the company to see whether or not there are any particular risk factors or anything so bad they don't want to invest or want to lower the price, etc. So that's the kind of perspective. And what we'd be looking in is not only patents, of course. I mean, patent is one IP asset you can have, right? But there's also, for example, trademarks. So if you have your name protected, your logo protected, that would be something that would be expected from a VC investor from at least seed stage on. So before, I mean, you don't do that the day you register your company, right? But shortly after, or maybe a year in, you would look at the domains they registered in their name. That's not a big point, but still something we always check. And then there's this whole complex of copyright, patents, and trade secrets. And that depends a lot on the industry you're in, of course, but also the stage of the company and whether, so it's not like, point I'm trying to make is like, you can have a trade secret, which is something you just don't tell anyone you're doing. And that's how you keep it safe from others. You just don't tell it to anyone and protect it inside your organization. Or as like the counterpart of that would be a patent where you tell everyone what you're doing But in return, because I mean, a patent, if you file a patent, then it's going to be public, right? The processes you're using. But in return, you get protection of that, right? And it can, and it's a balance to strike strategically, which way to go, at what stage, and what kind of process we're talking about. But that's something, for example, from a, like from an IP due diligence perspective, of course, it's nice if a company has patents already. So talking about early stage, of course, less so than later stage, where the whole IP strategy gets like is more getting more sophisticated. And it's harder to look at a trade secret, right? Because it's secret. And because even if you have signed an NDA with an investor, you shouldn't be showing them your trade secrets all the way. So for an IP due diligence perspective, having patents to even look at is nice. So you have something tangible, right? But then, in many cases, an investor would understand that it's not feasible from a cost perspective, effort perspective, timing wise, or otherwise to do that very early on, and we like would still be considered an IP asset they have, even though it's not like set in stone by a patent, right? Mm-hmm. And then a couple of pitfalls that that we have a close look or look at, and that can be easily avoided in the IP context, would be IP clauses in employment and freelancer agreements. So everyone working with your organization should have a clause in the agreements they signed with your company that they transfer the IP they're creating, right? So, and that's very, sounds very easy, but the devil is in the details. So that's something that a lawyer would have a close eye on. If you have valid and comprehensive IP clauses in all employment agreements, freelancer agreements, anyone you work with, because especially early on, that can be a super important addition to the product you're developing. If you work, for example, with the first freelancer you're ever working with, and the only agreement is you wrote a couple of emails back and forth telling him what to do, and they're like co-creating with you, and you didn't get the chance to fully transfer the IP he might have been created, especially in the copyright context. So that's something we have a close look on. And then also licensing in customer and partnership agreements is a big point. So also, especially for early stage companies, especially if you work with research partners, universities or big corporations that do R&D, and they always want to secure their little piece of the IP that is resulting from those projects. But for you as an early stage company, that can be super critical if you're licensing something out that you actually want to exploit later on as your core product. So that's also something that I would advise all early stage founders to be really diligent about when doing those agreements, because otherwise I'll be the person like finding that later on in a due diligence context. And we did like past deals because turned out all the IP created in that company that was of relevance for the investor was actually licensed to some big corporate, and they didn't even know. So that's an important thing to look out for. Like, always be super diligent about licensing clauses. And then something that is more of a general and organizational aspect is, for example, like we would have a look at how the company manages IP in their context, right? So for example, do they have an access management system in place? Do they have, do they work on a need to know basis? So does every employee just have access to everything, source code, patents, pending patent processes, etc.? Or do they have a process in place where only the relevant stakeholders will get access to that information in the first place? And that then also stuff like the offboarding process. So if early employees leave the company, make sure they don't take anything with them and they can't harm your business later on.
Hmm. Wow, you raise such important and often overlooked points that I really appreciate you sharing. And I was wondering if Shireen and Dr. Pehane, if you have anything to add on that note of some of the legal pitfalls that biotech startups often face and fall into that could be easily avoided?
Shireen, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, so definitely in the context of research environments, so often people are working with researchers in a university or a science council. In the context of those agreements, collaboration agreements, contracting agreements, obviously there's quite a lot to be sure of in terms of those agreements. Who owns the IP? Who is allowed to use the IP, who is allowed to make decisions about protection and things like that, that can really hinder people obtaining protection for their intellectual property and investment down the line too. I certainly want to echo what Lucy said about employee agreements, and especially because in sort of research environments, there's this, you know, wonderful spirit of collaboration that often leads to murky gray areas about who actually contributed what and who owns what. So while collaboration is great, it needs to be facilitated by proper agreements. So that really is very important. And then documentation, documenting who does what. It's very important for purposes of determining who inventors are. It's also important for the purposes of determining who has rights in intellectual property. So those are things that I would also add.
Thank you, Shireen.
So I think for me, the big thing that we're seeing now around the world is just this thinking around open innovation, where people are saying, let's put out, you know, our inventions out there for the good of mankind and so forth. And quite often these things are in direct conflict with what a company does, right? Which is invest in biotech, but with the aim of realizing a return on investment with considerable profit. And so some of these things we need to go into, I suppose, these biotech programs, understanding that, you know, the landscape is changing all the time. Where initially it was that said, you know, this is my intellectual property. I have exclusivity for the next 20 years, whatever it might be. You know, I need to exploit it, and nobody can, in essence, exploit my IP without my permission through a license and so forth. But this is changing now, you know, as the world becomes smaller. We've seen now with COVID, where there was a requirement, you know, for some of the COVID vaccines. Mpox is a good example now, where there's a requirement for these vaccines to be made available, particularly to those countries that don't have these vaccines. That speaks to this whole, you know, thinking around open innovation, collaboration and so forth. In the universities, I mean, as Shireen correctly said, you know, there is a let's call it a spirit of wanting to share information and so forth. And we find this in science councils as well. And what we've often had to instill in the scientists is that you absolutely need to get into non-disclosure agreements, number one. And number two, be thinking very seriously around material transfer agreements as well. Because often, you know, in the interest, in the spirit of sharing information, sharing samples and so forth, scientists do send stuff to their colleagues in envelopes and so forth. And that's, in essence, where the material goes offshore. And we see this, for example, for genetic sequences, where people have done some extraction of genes, plasmids, whatever it might be, and they give them to their colleagues to do some tests or even to overexpress a particular protein or enzyme. And without these material transfer agreements, without these non-disclosure agreements, you're typically allowing IP to go offshore. And so when there is a commercial interest, somebody finds something interesting around your IP, around your particular sample, it becomes really difficult to actually claim that this is yours because you actually gave it away. And so we talk about these kinds of things with scientists. We've had, even in the country, we've had some accidents where that is concerned. But of course, you know, with our partners, the National Intellectual Property Management Office, what we're saying all the time is that there's a requirement for this awareness all the time amongst our researchers and our scientists.
Thank you so much. I would like to invite everyone that is online. I think we've laid some really interesting groundwork in terms of context, content, insights, perspectives from, you know, both sides of the scale here in terms of the startups as well as what investors will be looking at in due diligence. If you have any questions on these aspects, please do not hesitate to put them in the chat, and I will be conveying them to our guest speakers in the next half or so of our session today. And while I await those questions, just to highlight some people that have joined us, Genevieve Thompson from South Africa, who runs a biotech startup, GeneVantage. We have Dr. Robert Karanja as well, from Kenya, who runs the East Africa Biosciences Studio, a biotech venture studio in Nairobi, Kenya. We also have Boipelo Manoko, who is an intellectual property expert as well, and Masisange Nketsu, who is a patent examiner in the biotechnology field at the CIPC. So I think really we're speaking to the right people here online. So please do share your questions, and if you have insights as well that you would like to share with the peers on the call, that will be very helpful, and I will be relaying that during this session. So as we continue our conversation, we have a lot of talk about contracts and the different contracts. I don't know, Shireen, seeing that you are in a local law firm that probably looks at these things on a daily basis or very frequently, can you maybe give us a rundown of some of the contracts that one should, be looking to set up in a general context? I'm sure as you go more specific, there will be variables. But is there like a kind of a rundown of what one should be looking at in terms of legal contracts at the early stage?
Sure. So, the contracts are very much determined by what it is you're doing and who you're speaking to. Mm-hmm. Contracts can be called all kinds of names. NDA, confidentiality. Basically, if you are doing research with another party and you are paying them to do the research, or they are paying you to do the research, so a third-party contractor, then you need to have a proper arrangement in place, even if it's just testing materials that you've developed, for example. So we often get into this gray area with testing of materials, which is not considered inventive, but they feel like because they have to give you the results, which you then put those results in your patent application, you've used their results and they think they should be co-inventors, co-applicants, have rights to IP. It's very important upfront to establish when you are contracting a party, you are paying them for a product, which is the test results, that they understand that that doesn't entitle them to intellectual property and that you've paid full value's worth for it. So collaboration agreements, as I said, that's usually where both parties are co-creating, they're possibly co-inventing. There it needs to be very clear who gets to use the IP. IP ownership and IP use are two very different things. You do not need to own IP to use it. And if you are the company that is going to be using the IP, you need to have access to use it. You don't necessarily need to have access to own it. And that's especially important in the context of people working with universities because of the Intellectual Property Rights from Publicly Financed Research and Development Act. The universities will insist on owning it. You need to have right to use it. The other kinds of agreements, as we mentioned, can't overstate the importance of material transfer agreements. Really, really can't. And also the material that you receive from others. Often researchers will, for example, receive a plasmid under a research license, and they think that that license entitles them to use the plasmid commercially. Doesn't. And they have to go back and get the right to use the plasmid. Often this plasmid is now incorporated in all of their products. And they now need to get a right to use that commercially. Certainly confidentiality agreements, confidentiality clauses in every agreement. And then I think very important, like Lucy mentioned, just standard operating procedures of how we deal with intellectual property, who has access to information, how that information is contained is certainly vital. And that relates to your employment agreements and those mm-hmm. kinds of contracts.
Thank you. I have a question in from Genevieve. And I'll read it as stated. She says, "Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the valuable insights so far. I have a bit of a technical question concerning patent protection frameworks. I've received advice from IP lawyers in the US stating that the IP framework in South Africa isn't robust enough to adequately protect patents, specifically because patents in South Africa aren't examined for novelty before being granted. With that in mind, I'll be really interested in getting the panel's thoughts on this perspective. Specifically, I've been advised against registering patents in South Africa for my biotech business because it is difficult to enforce or protect them adequately. Given that this is quite a bold statement, I would love to hear your views on whether this advice is valid, and if so, what alternative strategies could be employed to ensure adequate IP protection for innovations originating in South Africa?" I don't know who
okay,
would like
I'm
to.
I'm going to have to jump in on that one.
Sure.
That one is solely in my corner. I'm at the risk of speaking too much. Okay, so certainly there is a risk in only getting patents in South Africa because we are non-examining. Absolutely agreed. Our patent officers will grant a patent for a wheel. And that is just as it is. Is it enforceable? No. So basically, our patent office, while it is non-examining, of course, we know that that is poised to change at some point, hopefully in the near future. But while it is non-examining, the task of determining validity of a patent is left up to the courts. So it is correct that that is a very risky strategy. I have to say that from my own personal practice, what we do is we file patent applications, our first priority application, already in a jurisdiction like the United Kingdom, which is fairly reasonable to obtain a search and examination report. And then our clients make a call on where they want ultimate protection. A mm-hmm. South Africa only patent is risky, and it's very hard for anyone to determine or to put any value to it unless they actually go and do a full novelty and inventiveness opinion themselves to determine. So you may as well just have had a search report from an examining jurisdiction. Of course, we have things like the Patent Cooperation Treaty, a PCT application, which also allows you to get a search report. The ARIPO Patent Office does do substantive search and examination. In my personal experience, I would still prefer to go via PCT and then into ARIPO, because otherwise the ARIPO Patent Office can take quite long and may not give you anything of value for a very long time. However, if there is a PCT search report, then they often rely on that. So, no, it's absolutely crucial that you protect in countries where there is at least a way to determine that your patent has any kind of enforceability.
Thank you so much. And I don't know if there are any other questions. Please keep them coming. But I have a question for both of you, Dr. Pehane, as well as Lucy. I'd like to understand from both perspectives. A lot of the sort of IP for biotech, as we have somehow mentioned in this session, is sitting in universities. But in my engagements with a lot of founders or prospective founders and researchers at the universities, there seems to be a hesitance or a resistance, or people hesitate to tap into the IP that has been so, there's a lot of investment that has gone into generating the IP at universities, but to commercialize them, there seems to be hesitation from the side of investors and also biotech entrepreneurs. I would like to understand, first of all, if you have also experienced that sort of hesitation, where is that coming from? From Lucy's side, what can be done to ensure that the commercialization of the IP from universities still is attractive to investors?
Yeah, I think so. A core problem in that context is that for a university, there's usually standards that that require them to keep research open source somehow, right? Because that's what a university is all about. And then commercialization of IP, on the other hand, they're somehow in a conflict in the first place, right? So it's I would say you have to strike a balance, but then both are pretty much opposing interests, right? So the university trying to keep the knowledge and therefore also the implied IP available to everyone worldwide, and then any entrepreneur wanting to commercialize on that. So, I mean, I think you can be creative about how to, as also Shireen said, there's not only you own the IP, you commercialize the IP, but there's many models. And I think the universities, at least that I negotiated such a kind of partnerships with, were open to creative concepts around how to make the IP more attractive to an entrepreneurial co-developer. For example, using a clause that would keep the IP, the ownership of the IP with the startup that would be resulting from that project or that enters into the cooperation, but giving a license, a vast license to the university to use that and for their own purposes. So in a way that you can retain ownership of the IP, but also try to make the university happy with their specific goals. But there, of course, you have to be careful about competing businesses. And I mean, you don't want, as a business, you're more worried about your competitors than about universities using your IP, right? So if you find a way where you can make it available in the research context, but keep the competitors out of the game, I think that would be a healthy approach.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Fehane?
Yeah, well, from my side, I think this is a very interesting topic and it can be quite contentious. But the point is that universities have technology transfer offices, and their role really is to take this intellectual property from universities, science councils as well, and to commercialize it. The challenge we find is that at universities, the requirement is for the concept to be proven. And when we look at the technology readiness level, that's TRL 3, which is not attractive to commercial funders and commercial partners. What you need is to invest much more money to bring that technology up to TRL level 6 or 7 or even 8 before it's even looked at by commercial interests. Now, some of these commercial interests have the appetite to put some money into it, and to see to it that you actually get to a level where it is attractive for them commercially to commercialize, others not. Others tend to wait. And you typically find that, for example, in the pharma industry, where you come up with a new bio drug or even a new pharmaceutical drug, they want you to have proven certain things, the mode of action and several other things must have gone through several phase 1, 2, and I dare say even phase 3 clinical trials before they even look at what you're doing. And that, in those particular instances, that's a lot of money that needs to go into it. And so the opportunity has to be good enough to attract particularly your commercial partners to invest in those particular opportunities. So, the role of the tech transfer officers at the universities is to ensure that in addition to protecting the IP, they also get external funding to the extent that it's possible to take that technology to a level that is interesting to commercial interests. So what we see in the venture capital space is that, you know, venture capital was very much like private equity in the past, where they would sit and wait until these technologies are in essence de-risked sufficiently for them to come in. But what we're seeing is this is changing. The trends are changing. Where venture capital is now coming in a bit earlier, right? And so they are now taking up more risk, but they stay with opportunity until it has moved through the various tier levels. At the time that they exit to big pharma and so forth, in the case of biogenerics, they in essence stand to gain because they've in essence stood with opportunity. The value has been created. At the time that they exit, they in essence make a bit of a buck for themselves that way. Mm-hmm. And so all of these considerations, colleagues, are things that we take into account when we look at technologies from universities, from science councils, is to say what needs to be done to take these opportunities and make them attractive to the market. You know, we might sit there and say, you know, R&D is expensive, but I can tell you now that commercialization is anywhere from 10 to 100 times more expensive than the cost of R&D. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's easy to do the work, so to speak. It's more difficult to get people to part with their hard-earned cash to, in essence, buy your product or use your product. And so these considerations, you know, need to be taken into account as we look at what we've got in our arsenal of IP and versus whether it is ready for the market. And so part of the due diligence we spoke about earlier on looks at things like that to say, is the due diligence, has it been good enough? Do we understand our market well enough? And do you understand who might be the potential partners, commercial partners for that matter, to take these opportunities through to the market? So that it involves, you know, one, understanding the prior art, as the colleagues would tell you about, but also understanding who is patenting in this particular space and who might be interested in what you're coming up with. All of these, I suppose, questions need to be answered earlier on, even before the R&D program actually starts. Because the last thing anybody wants is, in essence, to hit a stalemate where you've got potentially a very strong, very active, specific monoclonal antibody for cancer. You know, you've worked around the issues of sickness and so forth. And now suddenly you can't raise the funding to take these things through to the market. And so all of these things speak to timing. It's a matter of timing, really. Even the timing at which you put out your patents, go out for protection, very, very important. There are certain industry nuances that must be considered, you know, as we speak about the life cycle sustainability plan of intellectual property management strategy.
Thank you so much for that insightful contribution. We have another question from our audience. Maurice Venter asks, hi everyone, at what stage of product development, considering technology readiness level, do you conduct a full freedom to operate study compared to a patent search and IP lawyer opinion? I don't know who wants to take that.
I suspect we're all going to have a different answer.
Sharon, do you want to take a first go at it?
I mean, a full freedom to operate, number one, needs a product. You need to know what exactly the product is that you're selling and where you're selling it. A full freedom to operate means essentially assessing all of the records in those jurisdictions where you plan to sell and determining whether you will be infringing anyone else's rights in those jurisdictions. That is something that happens, you know, sort of in preparation of going to market. You know, it's very difficult to say when. Until you have a fully defined product, there's just no point. And until you have a fully defined idea of which jurisdictions you're selling in and how you're getting in there, there's no point in doing a full freedom to operate, because they're quite a specific thing. Having said that, clearly the person asking the question knows that there are sort of more gentle searches one can do that cost a little bit less money, where we look, okay, well, which patent applications could we potentially be infringing if they became full patents, and what jurisdictions have they entered? And, you know, so we sort of do a risk analysis rather than you know, an IP landscape risk analysis as opposed to full freedom to operate, that I would suspect that you would need to do fairly early on in the commercial process before you have, invested significant money to only to find that there's something that like just prevents you from entering most markets, for example.
And from our perspective, we say that the time to do that, as Shirin is saying, is when you actually have something to sell in particular jurisdictions. Part of that full freedom to operate requires that you even have translators of patents and even of prior art, because we have found in the past that in the Far East, our Japanese and Chinese colleagues, put out patents in their own languages. And the last thing you want is to think that you're not infringing. You get onto the market, and they actually find that you are infringing. They will come after you as they should. But what it means, colleagues, is also part of it is to understand that people who put out IP out there are not sitting there and waiting to, in essence, for the 20 years to pass by, and they collect a few dollars from wherever they can commercialize. They're actually thinking about defensive strategies, right? They are saying, I've got a bio drug out there. The next best thing that I can do for myself is put on more patents around, for example, formulation or even delivery of this. And so you find that more and more patents are coming out around particular drugs. We see this particularly in the cancer space for monoclonal antibodies, where I think one company had put out something like 132 patents. By the time people actually wanted to get into the markets, they had to navigate around 132 patents. It gives an idea of the financial muscle that these companies have, particularly when they are convinced that their product is actually going to make a good buck for them. And so when we go into the space, even as startups, we should always be cognizant of the fact that people are not doing nothing. They're very, very busy. And the reason why this is the case, colleagues, is because, of the advent of, let's call them biogenerics, where people now are coming up with biosimilars, right? So it's the real thing. It is a biosimilar of a particular product. It requires that you only demonstrate bioequivalence. No need to go the full Monty as far as your clinical trials are concerned. And so people have realized that, if they do not come up with these defensive strategies, it is very likely, and we've seen this in the past with our colleagues in India and China, being able to very quickly flood the market with these biogenerics. And so people want to remain competitive and they want to continue making money for themselves. And so they come up with these particular strategies. And so I would advise, startups to be thinking about these kinds of things as well, because all of this, in essence, speaks to what the colleague has asked in terms of when do I actually do a full freedom to operate. It's when you have a product, you have a market, and you want to enter into those particular markets. Very, very important at that stage to at least by that stage have done it. You don't think about it at the time that you actually enter into those markets. Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pehane. And I think we are just 3 minutes short of the end to this session. And on that note, I would like to just wrap up the session today and thank everyone, our panelists, who were so gracious to share time with us, Dr. Weasley Pehane from University of Johannesburg, Shirin Trulock from Spoor and Fisher, as well as Lucy Ernst from Hogan and Lovells. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise. Your contributions have really enlightened us. And I'd like to thank everyone who came on to the live session today, and thank you for your engagement and questions that have made today's session really productive. And looking ahead, I just want to ask you to mark your calendars for October 28th. If anything changes, I will tell you. But we have a really exciting session coming up on October 28th, where we'll be looking at some innovative funding mechanisms for biotech startups. So we know the typical ones, and we've discussed some of them in our previous sessions, but we'll have some special guests that will be talking to us about innovative funding mechanisms that you can explore, especially at early stage, and especially when you are still very risky for the more traditional investors. And on that note, I'd like to thank our guests. I don't know if we have 1 minute. anyone wants to just wrap up with last remarks on what the key takeaways are for biotech startups, you can do that in a minute.
If I may start, I think for me, I think, you know, the whole purpose of doing this is because we want to put a product onto the market that's going to help people in the biotech space and help economies and so forth. And so colleagues should actually go out there. They should do these things. It's a very interesting, I suppose, space to navigate and to meet up with people, form partnerships and so forth, speak to the IP firms. It's very, very important. But there's also, you know, the satisfaction of knowing that you've worked very hard to put a product out onto the market and it's actually changing people's lives. I think people should be open to actually being acquired. So we might go out there and say, one day I want to have this big firm that makes 1, 2, and 3. Somebody might come up to you and say, I'm going to buy you lock, stock, and barrel, acquire you for so much. That dream of seeing yourself putting a product might not be yours, but might be somebody else's. And so let's be open to these opportunities and to know that, you know, the space is changing all the time. It's a very dynamic one, a very exciting one. But all the best to our startups.
Thank you. Shireen, do you want to go next?
I think I've spoken enough.
Okay. Lucy, any last words? Thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah, on that note, we will see you here again on October 28th, where we talk with some other guests about everything investment and funding related to the biotech industry. Thank you again for your time and contributions. Bye.
Thank you.